From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 21st day of July, 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, out of the office for the afternoon, so no update of the commodity markets. However, we will have a very good discussion with Bob Ray. He's the CEO of Illinois FBFM and has some points to take up about the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program. That money's still available for farmers and all kinds of business owners to take advantage of as a loan from the U.S. government, and it has a forgiveness clause. We'll talk about those forgiveness clauses and what those have already applied for the PPP should be thinking about, and the fact that others can still go ahead and apply for that cash. We'll also talk today with Nick Paulson, agricultural economist from right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, about production control measures, the set-aside programs that farmers are thinking about today that have been used in the past to help lift the floor, the price floor, that is, of commodities like corn and soybeans. It's a different world today, says Mr. Paulson, and they might not work as well as they did in the past, and they didn't work all that well in the past either. So we'll take all of that up in this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The CEO of FBFM, the Farm Business Farm Management Association in the state of Illinois, now joins us. His name is Bob Ray, to talk about PPP. Hey, thanks so much for being with us. We've had the couple of discussions about this government program that is supposed to help businesses of all types to be able to continue to meet payroll and some other things. You've been watching this closely, and the FBFM field staff have been talking to producers about PPP. Some have signed up for it and some have not. I think rather than talking about what to do after you've got these loans, maybe we should start at the beginning with what PPP is and that there is still money available.
That's right, there is. It's the Paycheck Protection Program, one of the early stimulus features that the SBA and the U.S. Treasury rolled out with the express intent of helping self-employed people during this time period, which would include many of our farm families who are FBFM members, as well as supporting payroll costs for small businesses. That funding is available to assist in that process, and many people have applied and have used those funds for those purposes so far.
How do farmers go about doing this, and the money is still available?
Funding is still available, and the application deadline has recently been extended until August the 8th. So if farm families have considered this before and decided not to pursue, they have one more chance to review their considerations. There's an application process they use with their local lender, provide some information about their 2019 income or for their payroll expenses during 2019 as well. Gathering that information will assist them in completing the application, and the lender then will help them continue the process for funding.
And this is to help make payments in what kind of way and for what duration?
The funding amount is generated by their 2019 earnings or 2019 payroll. That's the calculation that's used. The funds that are received can be used for payroll for 2020, rent arrangements, utilities, transportation expenses that are needed for 2020. And in the case of someone who's self-employed, they've coined a new term called owner compensation replacement, which is essentially paying the owner for the work they're doing in their self-employed small business farming activity.
Is there a difference between the very early PPP and what is available today? And I have a question on this because it's related to the number of weeks that are covered, I believe.
That's correct. The very first announcement of the PPP included statements that would require 8 weeks to lapse, and during that 8-week period, we would measure the amount used for payroll and other expenses. At that point, 75% of the funds were required to be used for payroll. And then recently they've relaxed those rules and given us 24 weeks to spend that money for owner compensation, replacement, payroll, rent, utilities, et cetera. And now only 60% of those funds are required to be used for payroll. So many people will be able to use the longer time period, longer than 8 weeks, and fully consume their PPP proceeds with payroll expenses, making that an easier calculation towards the forgiveness piece.
I want to get to the forgiveness for in a moment. However, I do have a secondary question. Does this mean that the 8 weeks versus 24 weeks is something that those who have already applied for PPP might reconsider?
Well, if they've already applied for the PPP, they have both choices available. They can use the 8 week period. They can rely on the 24 week period, and they can also use really anything in between. So if 12 weeks have elapsed and the borrower has spent all of those funds on payroll for their small business, they can start the application for forgiveness process and don't need to wait the full 24 week time period. But anytime in that 8 to 24 weeks, they can start the forgiveness application if they've used the money that would qualify for forgiveness completely.
Actually, what I think I'm asking is whether the loan amounts would be different for the 8 week and the 24-week period.
Well, the loan amounts would be the same in the calculation. The calculation was set at 1 month's worth of expenses times 2.5. So that's essentially around a 10-week or so use of funds use of funds to compute the loan amount. So whether we have an 8 or 24-week repayment / forgiveness period, that has zero impact on your loan amount. That's based on a different calculation.
So those who have not applied, money is still available, and they can contact their FBFM, local bank, whoever they happen to use, and are quite likely to be able to get through the process fairly quickly. However, there is a second point of this, because it is a loan for, if I remember correctly, 2 years at 1%, although there is a forgiveness clause in this. Can you talk about both of those sides of what this government payment is?
Correct. The first step in funding of the PPP was creating a loan between the lender and the borrower. So just like any other borrowing activity, a promissory note is created. The borrower, the farmer, will sign that promissory note, and they have an obligation back to the local bank that is guaranteed by SBA. So at the moment when you're done, you have a loan. And then once the 8 or 24 week or any number of weeks in the interim is consumed and the funds have been used, the borrower can apply to have the loan amount forgiven in full if they've used the right amount of funds for the right types of expenditures. At that point, which that process is not fully designed yet by SBA, but at some point they will then be able to have that promissory note completely discharged. They will be able to keep the loan proceeds that they received a few weeks ago, and the obligation to the bank will be ended.
How should farmers go about moving money from the accounts that are created by the banks and others to put these loans into their own bank accounts? Meaning, are there things that they need to think about as to how they move cash out of the loan accounts?
I think that's been a distinguishing feature among different lenders who've identified the processes that they prefer. And I think they're all okay. I don't think there's any that are more completely correct than others, but some lenders have decided to create separate bank accounts for those loan funds to be directly deposited into when those loans were completed. And then as the appropriate amount of dollars are expended on the appropriate expense amount, for example, payroll, utilities, and rent, then those monies have either been paid for out of that PPP bank account or transferred in an amount equal to those expenses to the typical farm account where those checks have been recorded. Some banks have not required establishing second bank accounts, but as long as the farmer is able to keep track properly of the expenses, again, the type and amount, that's what will be most important in the application for forgiveness coming up soon.
Any advice on how to do that?
We think the application process will be online for most of the lenders that we've been hearing from. There's a form out called 3508EZ, which will allow most people to use that for the forgiveness calculation. But it appears that's going to be an online activity for most of the lenders that we see. They're looking for that both to, I think, have some consistency in the application, some ability to do some easy reviews of the applications, as well as just managing workflow, as there were a large number of PPP loans created. And that means there'll be a large number that will have to go through this forgiveness process.
Bob, thank you so much for explaining all of this. I know we'll talk about it again in the future.
Thank you very much, Todd. Good luck to everybody with their PPP activity.
That's Bob Ray. He is the CEO of Illinois FBFM. Let's check now the weekly crop progress report from the United States Department of Agriculture. Around the nation, 34% of the corn crop is silking. The rolling five-year average is 27%. 69% of the crop in Illinois has silked. The five-year average there is 71%. Illinois, 9% in the dough stage. The normal is 10. And around the nation, 9% of the crop also is in the dough stage. And the average over the 5 years is 7%. 64%. The soybeans are blooming around the nation. 57% is the five-year average, 55% in Illinois, and the rolling five-year average there is 59%. Now, here are updates from the state statisticians.
This is Melissa Couch, agricultural statistician for the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service. Although some areas of the state received over 3.0 inches of rain, statewide Iowa farmers had 5.7 days suitable for fieldwork during the week ending July 19, 2020. Fieldwork activities included spraying, harvesting hay, and grain movement. Topsoil moisture levels rated 9% very short, 20% short, 69% adequate, and 2% surplus. Corn silking or beyond reached 69%, 9 days ahead of the previous year and 3 days ahead of the five-year average. Corn in the dough stage reached 6%, 8 days ahead of the previous year and 4 days ahead of the five-year average. Corn condition rated 80% good to excellent. Soybeans blooming reached 74%, 2 weeks ahead of last year and 5 days ahead of average. Soybean setting pods reached 29%, just over 2 weeks ahead of last year and 4 days ahead of average. Soybean condition rated 79% good to excellent. Pasture condition rated 56% good to excellent. Heat stress and increased insect populations continued to affect livestock. For the USDA, NAS, Upper Midwest Regional Field Office, this is Melissa Couch.
This is Dan Loftus, State Statistician for the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office. Above average temperatures and rainfall advanced crop development during the week. There were 5.1 days suitable for field work. Sporadic strong winds, hail, and flooding were reported to have damaged some crops and reduced overall condition. Field activities included cutting hay and readying equipment for the small grain harvest. Topsoil moisture supplies rated 1% very short, 8% short, 77% adequate, and 14% surplus. Silked corn at 70% was 6 days ahead of the five-year average. Scattered accounts of corn reaching the dough stage were reported. Corn condition declined slightly to 83%, good to excellent. Soybeans blooming reached 81% this week. That's 13 days ahead of last year and 1 week ahead of normal. Soybeans were 29% setting pods. That's 12 days ahead of last year and 5 days ahead of the average. Soybean condition declined slightly to 80%, good to excellent. For the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, this is Dan Loftus.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org. Up next, you know, there's a whole lot of discussion about agricultural set-asides and how they might control production in the United States and bring prices up. The Farm Doc team isn't so sure. We'll talk with Nick Paulson, agricultural economist. Now, tell me about this set-aside article that you've written. There are on Twitter and other places within the farm policy sector discussions about set-asides because of the low prices. I assume this is why you took this up. How prevalent is that discussion in your opinion?
It seems to be a discussion that's gaining a lot of traction. I guess you have to be careful on how closely you follow information sources like Twitter and how representative things like that really are. But it seems like, you know, the return to a set aside type policy, land retirement type policy to address the prices is something that's gaining interest. And, you know, I think me and Gary Schnicke and Jonathan Kappas and Carl Zuloff and Krista Swanson kind of all write for the Gardner policy program within FarmDoc, and we thought we needed to put together, you know, a multiple article series on the topic. And so as part of that series, you know, Jonathan kind of led things off and gave kind of a background and a history of the use of set-aside and land retirement programs in the U.S., just because it's been basically since the mid-90s, since we've had those as kind of one of the centerpieces of the safety nets or the Farm Bill programs. And then we've had a couple of articles that are more looking at, you know, what is different today than previous periods when set-asides were used from a policy perspective. And then we're going to have some additional analysis coming out in the next few weeks. But that's kind of what I guess triggered our thinking in terms of putting out some articles on the topic.
What's the bottom line of the thought processes of the FarmDoc team on this as a purposeful and useful tool, if it happens to be the case still today?
Sure. So I think kind of try to answer that in two parts and kind of what we've done so far. The articles, the most recent two articles in the series that we put out have really looked at kind of where the U.S. stands from a global perspective in terms of share of global production, market share of total global exports, and, you know, pretty compelling evidence and data that shows that, you know, we do not hold the position that we once held in terms of being, you know, kind of the clear world leader. We've consistently lost market share in terms of both production and exports globally over the last 30 years, and even going back further than that, it's been a declining trend for both. And so what that tells us, or what that should tell us, is that, you know, even if you think set asides are, so let's take for granted that set aside programs do work. You know, if you're accounting for a smaller share of production now and a smaller share of exports now than you were in the past, those set-aside programs are going to be less effective than they were, you know, 30 years ago. So that's kind of the first setup to I guess, our kind of thesis or argument and our goals in this series. And then kind of, to kind of preview, I think, where we're going with this is we're going to take a look at, you know, have retirement and set-aside programs even really been effective in the past? And I think the evidence on that is mixed and not real strong, just because, you know, we don't typically get, you know, the effect on prices that you might think, at least in the programs and the designs for those programs that have been used historically. And a big reason for that, and I think we'll cover this in some upcoming articles, is that when you have producers take land out of production, they just work that much harder on the acres that stay in production. You know, so they use inputs more intensively. They produce more bushels on the land that they're still planting. And so, you know, even if you take out 10, 20, 25% of acreage, you're not getting that big of a reduction on the production side of things. So, you know, those are kind of the I think the two kind of arguments we're making is that, one, there isn't a lot of historical evidence that land retirement programs, when they've been used, have worked as well as we had hoped. And then two, you know, we're not in a position globally, the U.S. is not in a position globally for most commodities anymore, where they can have as meaningful an impact worldwide by holding acreage back here only in the U.S. And then kind of the third piece to that, to even lengthen my answer some more, is, you know, we have to consider what the response will be from the rest of the world if we hold back production. So even if we were able to obtain some short-term positive price impacts by taking some acres out, we have other major production areas in the world now that can respond and can respond very quickly by increasing acreage and producing more intensively on the acres they already have to offset that reduction from the U.S. and ultimately buffer the effect worldwide. So, you know, whether we're talking about the former Soviet Union on more on the grain side of things, or we're talking about obviously Brazil on the soybean side, South America in general on the soybean side, you know, the U.S. is not the only major player. And that's a big change from, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Does the Southern Hemisphere production for both corn and soybeans change very much the ability of the United States to do a one-year production set aside in order to try to adjust supply and demand?
Yeah, so, you know, that kind of gets to the point I tried to make at the end there about the how quickly the world can respond. The increased role of Southern Hemisphere production, you know, what that means is that anything that we do in a crop year here in the U.S., they can effectively respond to that, you know, within the same marketing year for us, within the same, you know, 12-month period. They also have the advantage of being able to plant multiple crops. So, you know, soybeans is still their primary crop in most of their major production regions in Mato Grosso and further south throughout the country. But they could very easily shift corn into their primary production season and do more second crop soybeans. And so they just have a lot of flexibility given their climate. And then again, the offset between the northern and southern hemisphere in terms of the primary growing seasons, you know, like we tried to get across in the most recent article, they can respond basically within a marketing year. So it's not even clear that we could get a meaningful price effect from a set-aside program, even for a single year.
Nick Paulson is an agricultural economist from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. He and his colleagues have written an article and posted it to the FarmDoc Daily website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu on set-asides, how they work, and how they might not work under current conditions in the United States.